Hello, everybody, and happy Thanksgiving. If you are anything like me, you are sitting somewhere home alone-ish, sad that you're not going to see your family, and are wondering what exactly a Zoom Thanksgiving is going to be like. If you are otherwise traveling, I'm judging you, and a lot of other people are, but do what you got to do, I guess. Anyway, it's a weird holiday season, and I don't even know if I'm going to end up having turkey. It's very strange. So given the holiday weekend that, not a lot of people want to record podcasts right now, I wanted to share with you an episode that we recorded very early on. It was actually kind of a test episode. When I first started talking about doing a podcast, and some of you might have remembered this from a New York Times article that talked about it, but my former consultant, Bill Burton, agreed to do it with me. And he's pretty much the best person that I could think of to practice with, because he's known me since the very beginning of my political life, I guess. He was my very first consultant that came on board. And if you haven't heard of him, he's someone who's very well known in DC. He was Barack Obama's deputy press secretary at one point. He worked as staff at the congressional, Senate, state, and presidential levels in both campaign and official capacities. He is the founder of Priorities USA, which is the first and still one of the biggest major Democratic PACs. He's pretty amazing. I really credit him with so much of how we were able to develop and run the campaign and come up with the innovative commercials and approaches that I think were so effective in the way we approached my candidacy. I was connected to Bill very kind of by chance. There was a person who I knew through my work at PATH that worked at the LA Times, and he was the person who sold advertisements to political consultants, basically. And when I was talking to him about it, he said, okay, you're going to have to pick a political consultant. And there are only two that I trust, that the rest of them are shady. And Bill was one of the two. And we pretty much hit it off immediately. And, when a consultant is picking to work with you, in most cases, they're not going to get paid until way, way down the road because of the way it's structured. So they're really gambling on you. Like, are you going to be able to raise the money? Are you going to be able to, make it that far as a candidate to the point where their work is not just free? So, you also are really, as a candidate, kind of, you're putting your faith in this person who, especially if you're a first-time candidate, you don't know anything about the process. You, in my case at least, you have no idea, what steps need to be taken when, who to trust, who not to trust, how much money needs to be raised, if people are ripping you off. And it's a real issue, and we talk about a lot of this stuff. But, the main thing that... I can't even say the main thing. The way that it operated on my campaign was that Bill and the company he worked for at the time, which is called SKD Knickerbocker, big consulting firm, they were my kind of overarching media consultants. They did mail and TV for me, but throughout the entire course of the campaign, which for me was really close to 2 years, they were, people who advised you and who you talked about strategy and crisis communications and who liaised with the DCCC and with Emily's List and the big players back in DC and helped make sure that you were on the map and were making the right connections. And when I first started, I didn't even have a campaign manager. So someone from their team was effectively filling in on that front. So it was pretty crucial, but he is definitely the first person that I thought of in terms of making an initial podcast, and that was a while ago now. That was back in July, I think, is when we recorded it. So we have not yet had a chance to release this, but I think it's got great information. Hope you enjoy it while we're all off kind of moping, most likely, on Thanksgiving. All right, enjoy the episode. Well, welcome to the first edition of Naked Politics with Katie Hill. Bill, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me. So is there going to be a video element to this too, or is it all just sound that people are going to hear?
No, it's just, it's sound. This is just so that we can, you know, have a real face-to-face interaction and not just your voice.
Perfect.
Thank you. I'm honored that you're going to be my first guest. It seemed only appropriate.
The honor's all mine.
You're the ultimate insider too, and can tell us all the scoop on how politics is disgusting. Right?
I'll do my best.
Great. Okay, so why don't you tell everyone who you are and what you do?
Well, I am a strategist. I'm from Buffalo, New York. I've been in politics for the last two decades, since the 1900s, really. I've worked a lot in Washington, D.C., on the House side, on the Senate side, for a handful of presidential campaigns, and for President Obama's first campaign for president, and then at the White House with him for a part of the first term. And then I moved out to California, where I've been working with a bunch of candidates, you being among them, and do public affairs for a bunch of companies and organizations who are trying to make some change in the world.
So basically, you did politics and then you went and made money.
I did politics and now I'm doing more politics, and I'm getting to work with people who aren't just candidates, but like actually some pretty cool organizations.
But then you also made money.
I mean, I am making my mortgage payment.
You're making more money than you would make in just, you know, working for government or anything.
Well,
if I
were doing it the way Larry Householder was doing it as Speaker of the Ohio House, I'd be doing a lot better. I mean, he's a guy who got into politics and is doing pretty well. So well, he's going to be able to afford the mortgage on his prison cell. But
yeah,
yes,
that's true.
There are lots of opportunities outside of government.
I'm learning that too. We'll see how well they monetize, but it's a start. I know you because you were the very first person who, or the first official kind of person on my campaign, right? Like I don't even know how I would describe that, of what role that started as. So how would you describe it?
Well, I think everybody who does political consulting does it a little bit differently. And I think every campaign requires a different set of needs and tools and stuff like that. And sometimes you just make TV ads. Sometimes you make TV and digital ads and mail. Sometimes you are a therapist. Sometimes you're a big brother. Sometimes you're like light legal advisor. There's all sorts of different ways you can do it. But I remember when we first talked, we're on the phone. I was outside of, I can't say because of NDA, but I was outside of one of the most famous people in the world's homes, where I was going to do a media training with him. And and we're just sitting there, I'm in his driveway, and I just remember thinking that you were going to be a real different kind of candidate. And it was pretty exciting to like engage.
I think I probably fulfilled that promise.
You did.
Yeah, I remember it very vividly too, because I had met with another consultant and I was just like, I'm not feeling this. And it was our mutual friend from the LA Times who introduced us, Darius, remember?
Oh, right. That's right.
And he told me that you were one of the good ones and that there are very few of them. And so we had that call, and I was here in Washington for an advocacy trip for PATH. And I was standing outside of the whatever hotel. I don't remember which hotel. But I think this was at the point where it wasn't even 100% that I was going to run, right? This was the stage where it was, you know, either we're jumping in the next week or I'm not going to.
Right.
And I was, do you remember how that conversation went?
I remember you wanting to get my sense of whether or not you would have a shot if you got into the race. You were running against someone who was the nominee the cycle before, who had an ability to raise a great deal of money and had some real name ID with the Democrats in the district, even though it wasn't really where he lived. But there were a lot of people who really liked it. But what we knew and what was proven out in the primary was that people were looking for something new and different to the sort of candidacy that he offered. And as a result, I think that you were able to run the kind of campaign that you wanted to run and ultimately win the primary and the general.
I do remember, at that point too, and I was just thinking about this. If I hadn't had that random connection to the guy at the LA Times who told me even where to start with political consultants, I don't even know how I would have found you or how I would have, you know, how I would have launched a campaign. So, you know, that's one of the questions that I get from people who think about running for Congress or for running for any office is like, where do you even start? How would you even begin that? You know, there's this big barrier of just knowing people and knowing your way in. There's not a how-to of what are the connections that you need to have to be able to make this kind of thing possible. And, you know, you have to make the case to even be taken on as a client with a consultant. You have to make the case that you're going to be able to raise the money. And what would you say to someone who's thinking like, I think I'd be great in office. I think I could run a campaign. I feel like I'd be doing a service to my community, but I don't even know how to begin. What would you say?
Well, I would say, give me a call. I would love to talk to you. You can find my website at brysongillette.com. No, I think if we were having this conversation again, I would want to hear first and foremost, why do you want to be involved in public service? Because that question in and of itself weeds out a lot of chaff from the wheat. Mm-hmm. And then secondly, you know, what are your ties to the community where you want to run? Why is this specific job a good fit for you? Whether it's for school board, Congress, senator or governor. And, you know, what sort of ability do you have to put together the resources that are required to let people know about your campaign and your candidacy? Because it's one thing to have clarity on how you express your values and your vision, but it's another thing to actually be able to tell people about it. Mm-hmm. So we'd go through those questions. And
I remember you asking me all of those, and I guess I gave a satisfactory answer.
But, I think we're kicking each other's tires, and it worked.
Yeah, but I do mean like, how would someone even know how to find you?
You know, it is interesting because
there's not like advertising. Like, here's if you want to run for office, call Bryson Gillette. You know what I mean?
It is kind of funny. I was actually just looking into whether or not it made sense to do some like Google search and whatnot because I think that, you know, we're in a moment where a lot of people are turned off by politics, but there are emerging a lot of people who are really interested in politics, who are non-traditional, who, you know, who come from communities where they don't know political consultants. They don't even know lawyers a lot of times, right? Mm-hmm. And so I don't know what to tell you. I think it's a matter of you're going to have to do your best to either talk to your local party and see if the local office has folks that they recommend, although oftentimes the local party consultants are not always great, or do spend some time online seeing who's got interesting things on their website, who's got who seems like their values match yours, who looks like they're answering questions about how to campaign in this particular moment that we're in.
So it sounds like this is just one of those very clear barriers to entry where you have to do some digging. There's not an easy how to, and even, you know, if you go through one of the candidate trainings, it's not, you know, it doesn't mean that you're going to be necessarily hooked up with the person who's going to help you launch off your campaign. And I know for a fact that if I hadn't gotten in with you early, I wouldn't have known where to start. I wouldn't have, you know, known how to begin to shape something that could have looked like a campaign at all. Other than, you know, what you find online of like, this is how you, I don't know, there's like a campaign handbook or whatever, but it's certainly not something that's realistic in navigating kind of the environment. So what I'm hearing is that you should do some Google search advertising and there's probably some space for that. So
I think that's probably right.
What do you think is the worst thing that's going on in professional politics right now? Not your political answer, like, you know, not the one that you would tell your candidates to say as part of a message, but what do you really truly think is the worst thing that's going on?
Well, I have two answers to that. One is the normalization of some of the things that Donald Trump does and says, like just the fact that, you know, he's sending federal law enforcement into cities against their will to round up people in unmarked cars, not professing to be a part of a police force. And that's like the third or fourth story of the day. That's number one. But in terms of, I think the way you meant the question is like political practitioners, like what are they doing that's really bad? I think the thing to watch out for when you're looking to hire a consultant, and this speaks to your point about barriers to entry for candidates, because it's hard to figure some of this stuff out. But there are consultants in Los Angeles and across the country who oftentimes run their candidates into a great deal of debt, so that no matter what, they make money, even though the candidate may lose and have a really hard time reclaiming or raising that money to pay off the debt. I think that that is like one of the biggest disservices that you can do for a client. I've never done it, never intend to. And I think it's just, it's criminal the way people do it as a matter of course, you know.
Well, would you argue, would you say that some of that practice comes from the fact that a lot of candidates have historically been self-funders and, you know, they can kind of take advantage, the consultants can kind of take advantage of rich people who want to run for office and, you know, they don't really care, like they're going to pay for it, right? They're going to, it's not their problem once they lose. Do you think that's
if that were the case, I wouldn't probably care as much. But the truth is most of the people who run for office are folks who nowadays don't come from a lot of wealth. There are some people who are very wealthy who are in office, but I would say for the most part, people, they get to Congress and it's the most money they've ever made in their lives. But yeah,
you think so? You think that that's,
well, you know better than me, having been there. I mean, all your friends in Congress were certainly not making a ton of cash before they got there.
No, but I think we all also could have made a lot more money and we're on a trajectory to be making more money if we weren't in Congress. So we were broke because we couldn't have jobs while we were running campaigns. Mm-hmm. So we got there and we were broke. But I also think that, like, if you look at the median income of people in, you know, who have been there, but even also a lot of people within the incoming freshman class, there's still a lot of money that, you know,
really
allowed them to, yeah. Not necessarily the uber rich, but, you know, it takes a certain kind of family support or savings or, you know, a spouse that's able to support you to be able to just literally quit your job for a year and put everything into running for office. And there's no support. There's no, you can't take money from the campaign to pay for your rent during this time that you're running for office. So I think about that a lot. Just in terms of, who's even able to take that leap of trying to run. I don't know if you've seen that too.
Well, I do think that the point that you're making about how hard it is to run when you don't have a lot of money is exactly right. And the people who can't afford it, are in a position to be taken advantage of. But I feel the worst for the people who are first-time candidates. They've never had a job that paid a great deal of money, and then they end up with hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt that they've got to find a way to raise money and pay off. It's the worst.
So this is kind of that underbelly, right? Like when you talk about how much campaigns cost these days, how, you know, the cost of campaigning in general has just continued to go up. There's this section of people who are making money off of candidates and who are making money off the campaigns. Some of them are good and upstanding and committed to the cause and committed to helping people succeed. And some of them are shady. Is that basically the gist of it?
Yes, that's absolutely right.
So watch who you, if you're going to pick out a consultant, you got to watch who you're using.
Yeah, 100%.
So you, and kind of speaking of just like the underbelly of things, you were there when Citizens United became the reigning law of the land. How much did you see campaigns shift after that happened? And what was your experience with that?
Well, the ability of corporations to give directly to campaigns really changed things on the Republican side, because on the Democratic side, that's not a practice that even now after Citizens United, Democrats really do. But Republicans just kept dumping more and more money into races, which just put more money in the system overall, and also allowed for, you know, another level of anonymity when it came to like personal, unfair, just straight up false attacks. So Citizens United definitely made the world worse.
Yeah. But along those lines, you were, if I remember right, and maybe you can help explain this, but you were part of Priorities Pack, right?
I started it. Yeah. Me and a friend of mine, we started it together.
So explain that, because that was one of the first ones where you had to go behind the wall, tell people what Priorities Pack was and how that happened and what that was within kind of the, what that was for Democratic politics, because it was one of the first ever, right?
Yeah. Well, it was controversial when we did it, but me and Sean were both working in the White House and we saw what had happened in the 2010 cycle where Republicans just flooded congressional races with all this money from all these outside groups, primarily two, it was Crossroads and American Action Network for the most part. And so we decided that we were going to leave the White House and we explored the idea of starting a super PAC to help the president get reelected, a place where people could give unlimited amounts of money to support the president. And so we checked it out. It looked like there was a real appetite for it. We started it up. We took a lot of heat. I was editorialized against in the New York Times and USA Today. And then, you know, a lot of Democrats went on the record and said, it's not a good idea for Democrats to be doing this. But our point of view was, we're not going to, you know, to paraphrase Donald Rumsfeld, you go to war with the rules you have, not the rules you wish you had. Yeah. And if Karl Rove was going to be playing by one set of rules, we didn't think it was right that President Obama be left undefended on the same part of the battlefield. So, you know, we raised and spent a great deal of money to help the president get reelected. I think that our ads were, they were tough, but effective. And, you know, it started Democrats on a path of being able to have a strong outside game. I think in a perfect world, there would be no super PACs, but we're not in a perfect world or a perfect country. And so I think that Democrats should be actively engaged where they can be.
Yeah. I mean, that to your point, that's the, people often say, I've heard it more and more these days of why don't Democrats fight dirty, or why are we putting ourselves, and even with respect to my resignation, why are we holding ourselves to rules that the other side just clearly doesn't, right? And in many cases, that I think that does hold us back when you're up against a party or an enemy, for lack of a better word, that is willing to use whatever dirty tactics, but you're saying you're not going to, then it just puts you in a fundamentally weaker position. But so how would you say that a super PAC, like, well, let's go backwards for a second. So yeah. The Citizens United ruling was in the beginning of 2010, right? So in the 2010 cycle, the congressional cycle, for people's memories, the Obama won in 2008, the House and the Senate were controlled by Democrats from 2008 to 2010. 2010 was when Citizens United happened. Early 2010 was when Citizens United happened. Republicans were like, hell yes. And they spent all of this money through these super PACs. They just jumped on it. Corporations were like, this is the moment that we can take it back. Rich people who wanted tax breaks, who thought that Democrats were going to, you know, pass policies that helped regular people and not corporations and special interests. They jumped in and they said, we got to take back the House. And that's, they did that. Right. And so come 2012 for the reelection for President Obama's reelection, but plus, you know, all of these House seats, was Priorities PAC what you started? Was that really the only one? There was no House Majority PAC. There was no equivalent that was helping House or Senate candidates at that point on the Democratic side.
I think House Majority PAC, I don't know exactly when they sprang up. They did. They were there in 2012. They might have started in 2010, but maybe not. I mean, one of the things that happened in that cycle was, and this is one of the, I would say that we did a lot of good in the Obama administration. I would say one of the political missteps was the messaging going into the 2010 elections, which was very focused on this outside dark money that was going to have impact on these races. And the president even talked about it in the State of the Union that year. And just nobody found it credible. Even though what he was saying was absolutely true, people didn't think it was credible that other countries were going to try to play in our elections. And they didn't think that the outside money was as important as issues that mattered in their own lives. And as a result, for a variety of reasons, we got walloped in the midterms. And, you know, the Democratic Party saw a real decline over the course of the Obama presidency, except for his presidency itself and the things that he was able to do. But, you know, I think that voters at the end of the day have not seen this as an issue that rises into one of the top things that they vote on.
Until more recently, where one of the biggest messages for all of us in the class of 2018 that resonated, especially in these tough districts, was that we are not going to be accountable to big corporations and special interests. And in fact, the dark money the corruption kind of related to politics and what has happened with Citizens United is finally, I think, something that's resonating a bit more with people because they've seen how politics plays out as not benefiting them. When you see that, you know, healthcare policy is directed because of pharmaceutical companies and how they ensure re-election or election of people who are favorable to them, or, you know, anything else, right? That there's not a single issue that doesn't touch money in politics. And so we found that's why you have more people in Congress now that have taken the pledge of not accepting corporate PAC money. There is something a little bit, I don't want to say disingenuous about that, but obviously it doesn't change the fact that outside money can happen still.
Yeah.
Corporations, right. But the truth is corporations just aren't generally on Democrat sides. How often does the Chamber of Commerce endorse Democrats? Because we just don't, those aren't the values that we stand for, right? We're more in it for passing minimum wage and protecting workers than we are for, you know, the profit line. But so what do you think needs to happen to make sure that we are on that playing field? If corporations and the wealthiest people who want tax cuts are the ones that are contributing to the dark money on the right, who is on the left and why? And how do you motivate and mobilize that to even stand a chance?
Well, this is a key problem, right? If you're Sheldon Adelson and you were one of the biggest Republican donors, you know that if you give $100 million, which is a pittance to him, but if you give $100 million of your fortune to Donald Trump and congressional Republicans, and they're able to get into office and pass a $1 trillion tax cut, your tax cut may be, you know, $2, 3, 4 billion, which is a pretty good return on investment for a guy like
it's
that.
It's a literal investment, right?
It's a literal investment. And Democrats, you know, if you're a wealthy Democrat, you're mostly working against your own personal financial interest, because you know that if the people you want elected get elected, that means your taxes are probably going to go up. And it's just different. But the good news is that this cycle anyway, 2018, it was the case as well. Democrats are raising more money than Republicans and don't have to go to corporations to do it. They're going to grassroots fundraising. And frankly, some of the Democrats who are uber wealthy, but instead are doing very well, upper middle class, are also giving more money than they used to. And so as a result, I feel like Democrats, from a financial standpoint, have leveled the playing field. Where we haven't leveled the playing field, and I don't think we ever will, is on a willingness to lie and just be completely dishonest or attack in ways that are completely unfair against your mm-hmm. opponent.
Mm-hmm. You bring up an important point with the grassroots fundraising. My race was one of the most expensive in all of the House races in 2018. But we raised internally $8 million, just not, you know, that's not including any outside money. And there was outside money spent, but our average donation still ended up being under $50, even by the end. So the fact that regular people were chipping in whatever they could is pretty transformative to American politics. And I don't even think that we've seen the full effect of that. But if that continues, I think that that's something that is the piece that allows us to compete when, because no regular people are giving to, let's face it, you know, most Republicans. I don't know how Trump has raised the money he has from, other than it being cult-like. Mm-hmm. But
it's terrifying that they have any grassroots fundraising game at all. But I think that's absolutely right. People are, just average Americans are getting in the game much more than they used to. I mean, if you look at by the numbers, Americans spend like $5 billion a year on pet food, but only invest about $1 billion a year into politics. I'm not saying pets aren't important, and I met your dog Psycho, and I saw the chickens that lived in your bathroom from time to time. So I know you're into the animals, but you know, I think people are investing more in politics because they see how it matters more and more in their lives. And I will say that President Trump has done one thing. He's made politics something that's just something that some people watch as a hobby or out of, you know, sort of casually. And he's made it very clear that politics really matters.
Right.
You know, President Obama said elections have consequences. And boy, oh boy, have we seen those consequences in the worst possible ways since last year.
Yeah, I think this is the wake-up call that sometimes it takes the worst for people to realize how important things are. And
yeah.
I don't know. Let's hope that that plays out in November. Let's go back to Priorities Pack really quick. So when you started it, you had to – there's this thing called the wall. Can you explain to our listeners what the wall is with regards to PACs and outside money and you know, the money that comes from within campaigns? Because I think – having been in this now for a few years, and you obviously for much longer than that, it sounds very jargony. So if you're just to kind of give a 101 on outside money, inside money, what the wall is, can you do that for us?
Sure. So, okay. So here's the thing about campaign finance. You've got what a candidate can raise and spend, which is governed if you're a federal candidate. So for Congress or Senate, that's governed by federal election law, which means that you can give, I think this year it's $2,800 is the max. And you can give $2,800 in the primary, $2,800 in the general election. So if you are a household of two people who are doing pretty well, that means together you can give over $10,000 to a campaign, which is a lot of money. But that effort has to be segregated from any other efforts where dollar amounts over $2,800 a piece are given. So that means if you are at a super PAC, you're not allowed to talk to anybody on the campaign or anybody affiliated with any of the spending decisions on the campaign. So Democrats and Republicans take a very different view of this. When we started Priorities, you go back and look at the filings, we spent almost $200,000 in legal fees just to get started, to make sure that everything was perfectly in line, absolutely within the law. We had regulations for our staff. I sent an email. Politico reported on it. I sent an email to all my friends at the White House and on the campaign and said, just so you know, I'm starting an independent effort to help the president get reelected. I'll talk to you after the November elections. And so
I was going to ask about that because you basically couldn't, these are your best friends and you basically did not talk to them at all for like a year, right?
That's right. A year and a half. Yeah. We started in earnest in April of 2011 and then didn't talk to them until election day.
At all.
Wow. Like maybe we'd bump into each other at stuff like the White House Correspondents' Dinner or whatever, but we kept it pretty casual and didn't talk anything about the campaigns at all.
Because you just didn't want there to even be the possible appearance of any crossover.
Exactly. Particularly when President Obama was running like what was presumed to be or he wanted to be perceived as a very clean campaign that didn't have like those sorts of affiliations. Now, at the same time, on the Romney campaign, the people who are running the PAC to help Romney get elected were actually working out of Romney campaign headquarters until 3 months before the general election started.
How did they get away with that?
Well, the FEC is like completely toothless. And you can't get the FEC to rule on anything that would be perceived as particularly partisan because it's right now split 3-3 and a seventh member who could break ties isn't being confirmed by the Senate. So it's basically just everything's is just not followed. And so they followed what they thought was the letter of the law, which was to have no communications about voter contact, et cetera, over a certain period of time. And we just took it a lot more seriously. Now, I think everybody's a little more relaxed than we were at Priorities in that first cycle, but we were, you know, doing something that hadn't really been done before. So we wanted to make sure that we didn't get in trouble or get President Obama in trouble. That's the first rule of super PACs, do no harm. And we tried very hard not to do any harm.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that's a good point. If you're trying to help a candidate, then you probably better help the candidate.
Yeah.
What you went to pretty You worked for Obama with like the highest ethical standards. You started the super PAC with, you know, the highest ethical standards that probably, you know, we kind of knew that Republicans weren't going to hold to. But you also started, you know, these were pretty rough ads, right? That you ran against Romney. Do you have, do you want to, like, what's your favorite one? And how did you feel about doing that?
Well, so Frank Luntz says one of our ads helped President Obama win Ohio. That's the one I'm most proud of. It's called Stage. And it's, all of our ads were basically the same thing. We did some things that were outside of this mold, but for the most part, we produced ads that were just regular folks who worked in communities where Mitt Romney, when he was at Bain, would come in by the organization that they worked for, whether it was a foundry or some kind of plant, and then basically liquidate the entire company, cancel the contracts for pensions and healthcare with the workers, and he would make $100 million on a deal, and these people would have nothing. Their community would be shut down. Their families would be in ruined financial states. This is all true. Yeah. So they would just tell their story, and it was to devastating effect, because the truth was very hard for Mitt Romney to defend, and ultimately he couldn't, because, and that's why he lost. And yeah. So we ran those in a handful of battleground states, and you know, it was quite an experience. We ran that ad that I was talking about, Stage. Some people have called it Coffin, because this guy was instructed when he got into work one day to build a stage. And it was from that stage that
I remember Romney that commercial. Worked.
Yeah.
I remember the commercial. Yeah.
Yeah. I told everybody.
Keep going. Explain it. Yeah.
Yeah. So the Bain folks went up onto that stage, told everybody they would be fired. And he says at the end of the commercial, so building that stage made me feel like I was building my own coffin. It just made me sick.
Yeah.
We showed that, we ran that in, it was late June or early July of the election year. And in September, so months later, we go into focus groups in Ohio and we say, just open-ended question to this group of voters. What ads do you remember seeing on TV? First guy opens his mouth. He said, I saw this ad. This guy talked about building a stage and it was being his coffin. And it just made me want to put Mitt Romney in a garbage can. It's like, let's get that back on the air. And so we put it back up.
Well, the fact that that's the one ad that like pops to my mind when I think about, you know, the ads that were running, you know, Obama's reelection is pretty telling. I mean, it's hard. It's hard. Like it hits you right in the heart. So
yeah. Adam Magnus is this really great ad maker who went out to Ohio and shot that ad. It was really terrific.
Was working on that side, is that kind of what made you go into the side that you are now, where you make ads as your, you know, primary or a large source of your job?
Yeah. Yeah. It was awesome. It was awesome to be a part of that process and to learn about it from the inside with some really smart people who are doing it. Adam Magnus, Saul Shore, David Eichbaum, like they all like were really good ad makers, and doing it now myself for campaigns, doing it for you was so fun. I feel like
we had a great time making some of our ads. We had some great ads.
It was awesome. But yeah, it was a part of why I wanted to come and do this.
You won an award for one of our ads.
I did. Best ad of the year. Best Democratic ad. Yeah.
For what, with what organization was that?
Polly's, American Association of Political Consultants.
Nice. Prestigious award for a very small group of people who know what it is.
Best award you can get. Nobody else has given out awards for political ads.
Yeah, there you go. What's your favorite Obama story? You worked very closely with him for a long time. What's the best thing you can think of? Funny, not, I don't know, whatever.
Well,
whatever
it was... It's such a privilege. And I think that there's a lot of people who are out there who work in 10, 12, 14 hour days, like we did at the White House. The thing about it though, is that it's like, there's a lot of stress involved in what you're doing.
Yeah.
But I would say that my favorite moment in the White House happened over the course of a couple of days. I got to go to the first meeting that the president held with the bipartisan leadership of the House and Senate. And so, you know, I'm one of a handful of staff members who's in a room with President Harry Reid, Nancy Pelosi, Eric Cantor, John Boehner, you know, all the brass from the leadership. And as everybody's assembling, Eric Cantor, who was at the time the number two Republican in the House, starts handing out copies of a tax plan that he wanted to discuss in this meeting. And the president says to him, he doesn't even pick it up. He just like sort of like pushes it away on the table. He says, Eric, actually, I don't know if he even touched the paper. He said, Eric, elections have consequences and I won. And it was a moment where everybody was like, oh, damn. And I leaked it to Politico that had happened. But anyway,
Did you say you leaked it to Politico?
Yeah. Yes.
Let's circle back to that in a minute, but go ahead.
Okay. So then a couple days later, I was in the East Room, which is that room in the White House that's got the gold curtains and it's all sort of yellowy and fancy. And the president was doing a signing ceremony for SCHIP. By executive order, he was expanding the children's health insurance program from 8 million kids to 11 million kids. And, you know, looking around the room, there's all the people, all these people who would be affected by it, right? There were doctors, nurses, and then, you know, insurance folks and like families and their kids who actually would be impacted by this. And I thought to that moment in the Roosevelt Room a couple of days before about the president saying elections have consequences. And it was just like awesome to realize that one of the consequences was that these kids were going to get healthcare. And it's just really
just that fast it happened.
Yeah. I'd say that was my favorite moment in the White House. But riding around the helicopter was pretty cool, generally.
Riding around on the helicopter, I can imagine. Yeah. That's pretty cool. Some of the best stories from listening to the members, including the speaker, and those who were around in 2010, the fight to get the ACA passed, and the whip count, and the when they took that vote was. You hear war stories about that all the time. It sounds pretty incredible.
That was
people
awesome.
People voting knowing that they were going to lose their re-elections because of it. And, or there's a lot of debate on whether that's why people lost their re-elections. But still.
Some people maybe. I mean, that vote took courage for a lot of people who are no longer in Congress.
No, lost it right afterwards. I mean, that was 2010 was a pretty devastating year. So speaking of, you know, I mean, you go from Obama, who literally I cannot think of a bigger scandal than personal scandal, I guess, than the suit, like the Titan suit.
The audacity of taupe.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think he ever made that mistake again. But you now have, like, we can't, like you said, we can't even keep up with the scandals. One of the most horrific things that are happening on any given day is third or fourth in the news. But what is your, I think scandals now, with Trump, have just gotten so horrific that they're not even funny. But at some point during your career, you must have had a funny scandal or a scandal that, like, maybe it's fucked up, but it's still kind of, you know, it's not so dark, right? That it's Trump level dark. So do you have a favorite scandal?
Of my own?
Oh, sure. Yeah, that's even better.
Or of President Obama?
No, anyone that you've worked with. If you have your own scandal, I would love to hear it.
Well, I'll start with mine and maybe it'll help me think of one with Obama. Oh, yeah. Okay, great. I got it. Okay, so mine. So of those ads that we made about Mitt Romney, there was one, ad where I was like, I don't know if we should do this one. It just, it felt like it would maybe went a little too far. But I cleared it with a bunch of people. Everybody on the team was like, no, we should do it. It's a campaign. Campaigns are tough. And even people, a couple of people who had lost folks to cancer, which comes up. And in the ad, the person is talking to camera and he explains that when Mitt Romney came to town, shut down the plant, everybody got fired. He lost his health care. And then, which meant that his wife, who was diagnosed with cancer, wouldn't be able to get her treatment. And she died 7 months later. Now, tragic story. And like, that is a thing that happens when you lose your healthcare and you can't afford the treatment. It came to pass that she had healthcare, like the story, there's something about the story that was like a little funky. And so we got the shit beaten out of us for a week because of the spot. No, there's nobody defending it. And me, the one guy who was like, I don't think we should do this ad, was the asshole who had to go on to CNN
and defend,
like,
it. Yeah.
And, like, defend yeah. it. And Wolf Blitzer had me on. And so I go on to his show, and I love Wolf, fellow Buffalonian, great journalist. I have nothing bad to say about it. But he has me on. One reporter, while I'm sitting there, he has a reporter do a fact check on the ad, blistering, right? And then he's like, Bill, what do you think about all of that that makes you look like an asshole? And I was like, so I defend it. It's like an 8-minute segment, which is a long time on cable.
Oh, yeah. 8 minutes is a very long time on live TV.
Right. And so he's like, okay, we got to go to commercial break. But Bill, I know we said one segment, but will you come back for stay through the break so we can have another segment to talk about this? And I was like,
oh, God.
Ah, another 8 minutes. I'm on there. It's him. I don't remember if it was Dana Bash or Brianna Keeler, but there's two of them who are just like pounding away at me for the whole time. The only thing that got us out of that news cycle is that the day after that interview, Romney picked Paul Ryan to be his running mate. And people had something else to think about. But it was bad. I would say that of all my time in politics, I regret that we ran that ad only because my instincts said not to do it. And I went with other people's instincts. And it was just an important lesson for me.
Yeah.
For President Obama, you know, when I was on the campaign, I was the national press secretary. And so, like, one of my jobs was dealing with, like, some of the biggest news stories that would come across, particularly the investigative ones. I was just tweeting with Ben LaBolt about this today. One reporter decided they wanted to dig in on President Obama's drug use in his past, right? Because he writes about it in Dreams from My Father. He talked about it in some interviews. And so this reporter is like digging and digging and digging. He was talking to people who President Obama as a high school student had met in Hyderabad, India, as a kid. It was crazy. And then there would be these complaints that he wasn't getting called back. And I was like, oh, so you're telling me that somebody doesn't want to talk to you about their adolescence and illegal drug use with one of the most famous people in the world? It sort of makes sense.
That's shocking.
Right. So anyway, after like weeks, maybe more than a month of an investigation into his drug use, New York Times puts on the front page of their newspaper a story that basically says that President, then Senator Obama, had inflated his drug use to his political benefit and that he had never really done drugs before.
What?
Yes. It was furious.
That was the New York Times headline.
Yes. Yes. Look it up. This is...
Listen, this guy was so straight edge. He lied about how many drugs he used so that he could get elected.
So people would think he was cool. Outrageous.
Yeah, scandals are definitely different now. Do you have anything that you saw that should have been a scandal that was either covered up or just never made it to the attention that it probably should have gotten or would have gotten under a different set of circumstances?
I mean, like, you look at President Trump, you can say that about 100 different things on any given day. I mean, just the fact that his family is making so much money off of his presidency, that alone, you know, it's in the Constitution.
That's ignored. That's basically ignored.
Right. It's just ignored. I mean, in 2006, when I was at the DCCC working for Rahm Emanuel, I was a communications director at the time, and there were so many scandals that we uncovered. Don Sherwood, who's a member of Congress from Pennsylvania, we found a court filing in which family values guy, his mistress said that he would choke her when they were together and had like a police report with choke marks. Duke Cunningham was just making millions of dollars off of the Jack Abramoff schemes, Tom DeLay. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were a lot of scandals, but things that I feel like, I might, maybe as we talk, I'll come up with some, because every race, there's something that pops up where you're just like,
yeah.
There's one really congressional race I did in California. I'm not going to name any names, but the person that we were running against was essentially getting free rent in an apartment in a place that the person had voted to build, this mixed-use building. And because the political press corps has been so shrunk, there's nobody to even cover that sort of thing. And so that, which is just like straight up, you know, bribery or whatever you want to call it, was just like out there in plain sight. I think a lot of that happens in California, to be honest, not to make people cynical about politics, but because California is so big, you know, we're a state the size of Germany in terms of economy, the size of Canada in terms of population, and you've got, you know, a dozen reporters who cover the politics of it. And it's just, you know, a lot gets by.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's an important piece right there, is not to make people cynical about politics, because the point of this podcast is kind of, politics is dirty, and there's, people know that kind of inherently. But once I got in as a candidate and as an elected official and now on the outside, there's so much about it that is dirtier than people even know. But there's also something about it that, even though I've been through what I have been, I might be a little bit cynical about politics, but I still believe in it. I'm still staying adjacent to it. I mean, I live in Washington, D.C., and I started a PAC, and I have a lot of people who are close to me who said that what happened to you makes me say, fuck it, I don't believe in politics at all. I'm going to have to drag them to the polls to vote. But I still believe in it. And it's obviously you do too. Why? What is it? Even though you're surrounded by this mire, even though you see the nasty stuff that happens up close and personal, even though, you know, there are so many things broken about it, what is it that keeps you hopeful about politics and why we have to keep having it? You know, why we keep doing it?
Well, you know, I'm driven by like two main ideals. Like, one, that what President Obama said, elections have consequences, right? And Paul Wellstone, who is a real hero of mine, senator from Minnesota, who died tragically in a plane crash in 2001 or two, who would say, we all do better when we all do better. And I just think that if the good guys and gals in this country aren't constantly putting their shoulders to the wheel of the political machinery, then the assholes are going to continue to control everything. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Freedom Caucus in the House and President Trump and his allies and the corporate interests who don't have our interests in mind are just going to win every single time. Mm-hmm. So I feel like I stay involved in politics because I feel like it's really important to be involved in politics. And I love being a part of it. It's, you know, I think giving people a voice is one of the most powerful things that you can do. But also because I feel like some of us just have a responsibility to do it.
Yeah. I agree. I think that's why I'm still there. I feel like there's a certain amount of obligation that when you have something that you can give to whatever level it is, right? Like, whether it's, you know, through your contributions to your own community or something else, then you gotta do it, or we're all going to pass the earth on to the next generation in worse shape than we found it, which is pretty fucking tragic. So
yeah, totally.
All right. Since we're almost out of time, last bits, if you could change one thing about politics, you know, aside from the obvious, like who is president, one systematic thing, what would you change?
I would try to do everything I could to take down the barriers that are out there to running for office. Yeah. Because if you look at, you look at a lot of people in the legislature, you look at a lot of people in Congress, the people who rise to those positions are often not, it's often not because they're talented at getting things done on behalf of the people that they're working for. It's often because they're talented at doing favors for people who are supporting them. And so if you get like these slimy political hacks who make their way up through the process and are just like glad handing and climbing and making friends with corporate interests the whole time just to get ahead, it makes it harder for just regular committed folks to get into the game. You know, in the whole rest of the country, not to over index for California, because I know you're going to have listeners from all across the country, but, you know, you look at some areas of LA, in the country, Democrats do not take money from oil companies. They don't take money from like major polluters. But in Los Angeles itself, like some of the core Democratic members of every body up and down the state take that money. And that's what fuels their candidacy. And it makes it hard for someone who was like you, who's working at a nonprofit, making a difference in the community to get involved. It makes it hard for, you know, all these first time candidates who are, you know, I work with a lot of them. It just makes that climb so much steeper. I would want to change that somehow.
So making it easier for people to compete, like public financing of campaigns, is that something that?
Yeah, I can get behind public financing of campaigns and just, you know, make it easier for people to find a network that can help them make their way into politics.
Kind of circling back to what we said at the beginning.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to say? Anything else that you feel like is something that people should know? As we, you know, I don't know, try to expose stuff and help people understand what this is all about and what we can do about it.
Well, I would say that politics can be a very dirty business, but it's not going to change unless candidates get in the game who are committed to changing the system and committed to focusing on the things that are most important to their communities. And it's hard to be a first-time candidate. And there's a lot of indignity that goes with it. There are the people will show up who you never thought were going to show up to help you out. And there are people who you think are your friends who won't show up. And people who think you're your friends who will actively harm your ability to do it. But I think that unless people really get into non-traditional candidates really get into the game, we're not going to really be able to change the system.
And people support those non-traditional candidates, right?
Right.
Most people will never run. Most people don't want to run. Most people, you know, just it's not going to happen. But everybody right. can support someone who's running for something that, you know, deserves to be there. But it takes actually getting involved. It takes actually paying attention. It takes, you know, chipping in a few bucks or knocking on a few doors or making a few phone calls. And it's not something that's just going to happen passively. Otherwise, you're right that the corporations and the people with money and the slime balls are going to be the ones who rise to the top. And
yeah.
Well, right. Thank you so much, Bill. I appreciate you, everything that you have done for me over the last, you know, 3 years. How long have we known each other now? It has been over 3 years, I guess.
Yeah. So since early 2017.
But yeah, in March of 17 was when I jumped in as a candidate. So,
yep.
I hope you'll join us again.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And I will. I'll talk to you
all
soon.
Right. See you later.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Bill. It's pretty funny to listen to an older episode and what it was like when we first started. I have to say the investment in a microphone was worthwhile. And thank you to my uncle Nate, who really kind of pushed me to get this microphone that I'm currently holding in front of my face and using, so you have the higher sound quality as we've advanced as a podcast. But anyway, this was a great interview. I'm really glad we're able to finally get it out there. I hope you enjoyed, and I hope you all have a great week and do the best you can with Thanksgiving. Talk to you soon.